Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Coming to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, streaming everywhere on KBOO.FM. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from Karl Marx's figure for the revolution, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. He mentions the mole in his essay on the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, about the 1851 coup that made Napoleon's nephew dictator of France. And more broadly, the essay is about the processes of material social change. Elsewhere in the same essay, he writes, quote, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And just as they seem to be occupied with revolutionizing themselves and things, creating something that did not exist before, precisely in such epochs of revolutionary crisis, they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service, borrowing from them names, battle slogans, and costumes in order to present this new scene in world history in time-honored disguise and borrowed language." Here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we believe that men and women and people of all genders, or none, we make our own history, but we do not make it just as we would please. The circumstances we encounter today and that we have inherited from the past help shape our tactics and strategies, our political actions and possibilities. But we believe that people working together can make molehills out of mountains, and we can root them down. Today's show is all about debating how to make our future history. Do we build new worlds in the belly of the beast, or is that just selling out or a waste of energy? Armed insurrection or legislative change? Can capitalism be reformed, or is it inherently unequal? Can we seek the protections of law, or is it better to take direct nonviolent action? Stay tuned. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab. Those audio posts generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also friend or follow us on Facebook or Twitter to find out when the week's show is posted online. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Contact us if you're doing activism, planning events, engaging in movement that our other listeners will want to know about. We'd love to hear from you. Later on today's show, I'll have a commentary on today's holiday commemorating the French Revolution. Tom Becker will be offering a well-read read on the question of whether capitalism necessarily tends to generate inequality. Jan Hocken will be talking with activist Kate Raphael about the Supreme Court's recent decision in McCullen v. Coakley, striking down no-protest buffer zones around reproductive health care clinics that provide abortions. Raphael has argued, not uncontroversially, that buffer zones provide little real protection from anti-choice violence, that they model restrictions on speech and protest, and that they increased clinic reliance on policing. But for our first segment today, Bill Resnick talks with erstwhile mole Norm Diamond about worker cooperatives and their significance for the left. Do they prefigure the democratic production of socialism and empower participants, or are they fragile small businesses that either become as cutthroat as other capitalist enterprises to survive, or else fail, having distracted their members from more promising mass organizing? In addition to having been a past collective member and frequent guest of the Old Mole Variety Hour, Norm has been a determined organizer, editor of the Portland Alliance, professor at Antioch College, president of the Pacific Northwest Labor College, and the writer of many, many articles, as well as the co-author with Bill Bigelow of the book Power in Our Hands, an innovative curriculum for exploring some of the most important labor struggles in U.S. history, the transformations of work, and the impacts of those transformations.
Hello, folks. I'm Mole Bill Resnick with Mole Norm Diamond. We're going to discuss a hot item now for progressives, cooperative production and cooperative workshops. We have many co-ops here in Portland, for example, City Bikes that sells and repairs bikes and bicycles, and People's Grocery Store. In both, the workers democratically manage the business. And at the national level, several large cooperatives with multiple businesses grouped together in inner city neighborhoods, one in Jackson, Mississippi, the other in Cleveland, Ohio. They've been heavily promoted in the progressive press as a crucial focus for progressives, for radical organizing. Norm, the promise of cooperatives to free working people from wage slavery, the tyranny of bosses, and to free them to have comfortable lives, producing for one another, that's been a repeated theme on the left. There's been a lot of experimentation. Let's talk about what was learned.
Bill, it's been an intermittent theme. It's not been a continuous theme on the left. And right now, we're getting a strong upsurge in interest in worker co-ops, I think for various reasons, but one of them clearly is the failure of dominant institutions. People are generating co-ops partly as a survival mechanism. That's true in Jackson, Mississippi. It's true in Cleveland. People project those co-ops as if they're alternative institutions, as if they have promise not only as a model for a future society, one that empowers workers, one that's environmentally responsible, one that even provides fulfilling work, although I think that probably doesn't correspond to the real experience in Cleveland. We'll get to that, and to Jackson. But also people project them as if they were transition institutions out of capitalism to something different. And there, too, we're going to raise a challenge to that kind of prospect. As survival mechanisms, they have a long history. There's a hidden history within the African-American community of forming co-ops. As well, going way back to the 19th century, Knights of Labor generated more than 200 producer co-ops where the workers ran their own little enterprises specifically to not have to be responsive to market forces. But there's the rub. Unless they're very little niche enterprises, of course, they're subject to market forces, and that can destroy them or undercut the promise also.
You know, most, in fact, are relatively small businesses. Workers don't have the capital. Banks won't loan the capital. Every now and then you get a foundation that will set one up with several $1 million, as in fact in Cleveland. But still, even in Cleveland, the two co-ops that have been set up and one in planning are going to be small businesses competing in the market for these services that they provide. And the only way to compete in that market is either to do it so much better, which they can't do in their services, or to keep wages low. In Cleveland, my understanding is the wages start at $8.50 an hour, and then they go up to $10.50.
Yeah, and these are very far from worker-controlled enterprises. The problem they regularly encounter is other corporations won't buy their products or won't supply them.
Or they can't get financing.
Yeah, operate based on a kind of self-exploitation on the part of the workforce. We have a rich history here, we should acknowledge, actually, in this area in the Northwest.
The plywood co-ops, yes.
Yeah. And I used to take tours of people through the Linton plywood co-ops and, of course, end up meeting with their members. There was a while when they flourished, but they ran into yet a different set of problems operating in a capitalist economy. Yet workers owned shares, and the shares became so valuable they couldn't be sold, for one thing. And another thing was when you're flourishing, you're hiring new workers. And they never figured out a way to bring in new workers into the cooperative mechanism. So they ended up with a dual workforce. You know, one, the owners, who weren't making any more money necessarily than other workers, but whose shares were making them rich.
Most of the plywood companies were bought by Weyerhaeuser and bigger ones because they were so efficient and so successful, but bought for huge amounts of money. And the co-opers made a killing and had very, very, very comfortable retirement. But the new workers they brought in who couldn't buy a share, they could have bought a share. Their salaries weren't so enormous.
New hires were exploited the same as they would be in any other kind of enterprise because there were market pressures. This was not a mechanism to somehow escape the forces of the market.
No. Well, it did escape the highly hierarchical nature of capitalist firms. I went to visit Linton, too, and I went to one of their meetings just as an observer, and they really were democratic. 80% of the share owners and workers were there making decisions. Managers could make a decision for a $5,000 maximum. After that, the workers voted on it and discussed it. They were in charge of their plant managing a productive operation. And I think that's something for those men. It not only was a comfortable retirement, it was a life of participating with others. And they were very tight with one another. And they also rotated jobs so they just didn't get into repetitive injuries from. It was a better place to work.
Good. You're raising criteria that I think let us evaluate these enterprises, how much they change the labor process, for instance. You haven't mentioned that, and I didn't see that much in Linton Plywoods. The work itself was still structured in many ways the same way as in
other. They had an assembly line.
Yeah.
You can't do craft plywood one sheet at a time, gluing with your paintbrush.
Well, then you're raising yet another question, which is really interesting in evaluating any kind of co-ops, and that's who decides what gets produced, what technologies come in, all those kinds of questions. And then we're talking about more than the workers themselves. We're talking about, as well, ties with community. So already we're raising large questions that need to be addressed to think of these at all as transition kinds of institutions.
Well, let me though say something. You can be the devil's advocate, and I'm with the angels, Norm.
This is the usual arrangement in the Old Mole. Everyone should know this. Yes, go ahead.
Support those angels with gifts to KBOO Radio and keep this station alive. As Seymour Melman looked at various industries around the world, including plywood, and he compared the productivity, just the sheer productivity of a cooperative enterprise with a standard capitalist hierarchical one. And what he found was that they were far more productive, actually, which is why Weyerhaeuser bought Linton and bought others. The left has always said, look, and I say it all the time, what it demonstrates when a co-op is really working well, it demonstrates that ordinary folks doing a variety of industrial jobs, they make intelligent decisions and maintain the plant and do it better and hire and manage their managers. And it demonstrates that when you operate together democratically, it works better and it's good for people and it's more, quote, efficient or productive. And that includes the service and caring industries as well. And now, Norm, you can reply to that celebration of the cooperative ideal.
Ideal is right. No, there's no question at all that the cooperative movements we've had historically, 19th century up till now, in some ways model possibilities, show workers, in fact, can run the economy. There's no question. There's that capability demonstrated in practice. The question is, building co-ops, is it a transition to something better, to a different way of organizing a society? And there, I think, is where the real questions come in. And I am skeptical. What it really comes down to is how you go about building those co-ops and how you function within them, how you generate allies, what kinds of alliances, what kind of changed understanding happens within them, people's sense of capability and sense of activism, especially their sense of where the problems are in the society, why they're even building alternative kinds of institutions.
Let's get to that. I'm going to do a station ID, and then we will discuss the criteria that you were setting for evaluating these co-op efforts. I think we can be a little more critical in some ways of co-ops when they present themselves as the road to a better society rather than as a interesting sort of reform that has many useful purposes, but not the major focus of strategy. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here with Norm Diamond of the Old Mole. Both of us do Old Mole work. Norm, not as often as me, but we always appreciate his presence. And sometimes the host shows. And we'd love to have you do it this summer, Norm. Are you committed to doing it sometimes in August?
You realize calling me a devil is not quite the way to, promote my participation.
The devil's advocate is just being, that's what lawyers are. They advocate for anybody. On this show, for this purpose, you're the devil's advocate. You aren't a devil. And I'm on the side of the angels.
Lawyer was a career path that I rejected.
For good reason. From one who knew once upon a time. Norm, let's deal with each of those criteria you set up.
Yeah, the worker co-ops that we've seen are very much survival institutions. They do model possibilities. They have that merit. And they are enabling people to get by in an economy that can't provide jobs. The question, again, is whether in projecting them as means in and of themselves, I'll make a blanket statement. There's no institutional arrangement. There's no structure of an enterprise that per se gets you out of capitalism. Capitalism, the kind of economic system we have, is very flexible. There's all kinds of room for dissent within it. There are all kinds of niches for different possibilities. I've lived in communities where anybody could set up alternative little institutions and serve the local community. It doesn't end up challenging the overall kind of economic structure we have, nor the dominance of the large corporations.
Well, that may be true, but I think the response to that is, if you look at it in terms of a development path of the current system, it seems to me that the more people who have experienced some kind of democratic workplace will, when, in fact, the system is forced into another one of its great rending reconstructions of the last several hundred years, it's going to have to change its whole industrial structure and the way it operates in response to this ecological devastation. When people are forced to choose, and it's going to require huge amounts of state resources and investment, when that happens and when people are have to choose to change their former way of life, it seems to me that if you had enough people who had experience in democratic workplaces and in democratic practices, not just workplaces, they may choose a path that's different than the path that the corporations and the admittedly fascist forces are going to choose. And it seems to me we have to promote those sort of democratic ideas, and co-ops are one way of promoting them.
I hear a very speculative, highly optimistic sense of worker co-ops. One is that, in fact, the existing ones are democratic or more democratic. I think you made a convincing case about some of the plywood operations, all of which have failed, and that those indeed had more democratic structures. If you look at what's happening in Cleveland now, in Evergreen, again, you pointed out minimum wage workers, and they have to hire managers. And, you know, the managers make the decisions, supposedly on behalf of the workers, or taking the workers' interests into account. When the steel mills were going to be restructured into worker ownership, the entire plan gave workers presumably 6 out of 15 members on the board of directors that would make the ultimate decisions. But it all was going to operate within legal parameters. They couldn't even talk to the workers they were representing. These are not democratic structures. It's not democratic experience. 2, and I want to come back to that point, what all this comes down to is how to actually work within these contexts, how to work with these reforms. But let me make the second point then about the optimistic statement, people who think of this as a strategy for change. It really is reliant on the state. It's not just that worker co-ops are being established now, but there's legislation. You know, Vermont has its own actually twofold kind of impulse. One is to create employee ownership training centers, and the other is a bank that will lend money specifically to worker co-ops, dependent on the state. No other state has gone in for that, but of course the Vermont senators have introduced that in the U.S. Senate. We'll have to see. We'll have to see what kind of a role the state, the U.S. government, and that structurally the state can play in this transition. I am not as optimistic because that state, at least right now, of course, is not responsive to those kinds of forces. These forces aren't going to work without funding sources, without the kind of technical training, without the kind of purchasing power represented by the state. But let's go back a step, though. The real issue, I think, comes to, as it does with any of our political enterprises, how do we actually work with reforms? When this is happening, what's our role trying to push further than just creating these survival institutions? We have to treat this as if we are indeed political organizers. We join the effort, but we try to push it further. We try to make these enterprises, for one thing, responsible to the community that surrounds them, too. We try to create those alliances, and we try to generate an understanding on the part of the workers involved that, look, you're showing how capable you are. We push that further, but we're also, what's the source of problems in this society? What needs to be changed? How does this new recognition of our own capabilities, how can that lead to something further? With whom can we join?
Yeah, and ask co-ops and insist that any co-op you're part of is part of a larger co-op system that shares those values and promotes them and uses some, if the co-op is succeeding sufficiently, uses a major part of its surplus or profits to, in that fact, enable other people to begin enterprises rather than being dependent on financing from either foundations or government or banks. It seems to me you would want to see them confederating the co-ops, confederating away behind those radical principles.
What are the radical principles they're confederating around? I mean, you're still talking in structural terms, and I'm having a little bit difficulty seeing it, actually. I think this is a question of our political practice, the left's political practice. Like any other reform bill, the radical principles have to be one. What I look for is, I said before, a reorganization of the labor process, for one thing. So it's not people doing the same kinds of jobs that indeed have been structured with a built-in sort of hierarchy.
I agree. That should be one of the principles. That
has to be an involvement of the community.
I agree.
Another thing. And the community has to be part of deciding what the work outcomes are, what's being produced, and the allocation of profit.
Absolutely.
And the third, and I think major, has to be building a kind of consciousness. It's not enough to have a little bit different practice. People have to realize that the practice is different and have to understand it in that larger kind of context. We're not just making whatever little widgets we're making or producing lettuce like in Cleveland, the Evergreen Co-op, but we're building something toward taking down the larger economic structure, because it's what causes the problems. It's what doesn't provide employment. It's what's behind the vast inequalities in the society, etc. How the problems are understood by the workers themselves is key to the possibilities here.
Yes, and we will have co-op newspapers and radio stations and democratically run, like this one, sort of, to help, in fact, develop that set of ideas, because these co-ops are not going to stand alone. They're going to be part of this larger cultural, political, productive structure. On the other hand, there's actually much more to say that we're going to have to say at another time. Co-ops cannot be the focus of building the other better possible world and necessary world that we need. Really, the focus has to be on mass movements of people who have no chance nor will be ever in cooperative production, even if they know about it. And our movements can, however, be democratic. Anyway, that's my last word. You can have your own last word, Norm.
No, I think that's a good way to conclude. It's those larger social movements where people also have the experience of participating in major kind of decisions, not just production kinds of decisions, but
right,
policy decisions about the movement, about the society.
Thank you, Norm. This is Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond for the Old Mole, Old Mole Roundtable.
And for the angels and devils, apparently.
You're still.
I got called a devil, yes.
You did not. You were called the devil's advocate.
Okay.
You were just playing a role in a dialogue. Thank you very much, Norm, and don't be so sensitive. It'll undermine your political organizing efforts.
World is run by lazy drones and saws and us alone. We have laid the wide foundations, built it skyward stone by stone. Hell yeah, you know it's ours, not to slave him but to own, cause the union makes us strong. Now they have stolen until millions that they never were to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can smash their power, take our freedom when we learn. The union makes us strong, cause in our hands we have a power greater than the holy gold, greater than the strength of armies multiplied a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, while the union makes us strong.
That was Solidarity Forever, with lyrics written in 1915 by the IWW member Ralph Chaplin, performed there by MC Lynx. And of course, those lyrics are the source of the title of the book, Power in Our Hands. Before the song, we heard the book's co-author, Norm Diamond, talking with Bill Resnick about worker cooperatives. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Later today, we'll hear from Kate Raphael talking with Jan Hocken about the Supreme Court's decision against no-protest buffer zones around abortion clinics. And Tom Becker will have a reading on capitalism and inequality. But now, I want to talk about Bastille Day, or Bastille Day. The 14th of July marks a key event of the French Revolution in 1789, and the French Revolution, in turn, is generally seen as a key turning point in the transition from feudalism to capitalism. The storming of the prison was both a symbol and an instance of people collectively claiming freedom. But although the revolution entailed the repeal of the laws supporting feudalism in France, capital relations had already been developing, and those material changes had also made possible the Enlightenment ideas of 18th century thinkers like Rousseau and Voltaire and Thomas Paine, ideas that, in turn, also contributed toward the American War of Independence and then the French Revolution. Of course, things did not proceed ideally after 1789 either. Various factions fought with each other and sliced off quite a few heads over the next 10 years, at which point most historians consider the revolution to have ended with Napoleon Bonaparte's 1799 coup. Further republican revolutions and restored monarchies continued to trade power, alternating workers' revolutions, bourgeois republics, dictatorships for the rest of the 19th century. That is, although the storming of the Bastille was a significant and enduringly symbolic event, the actual transition from feudalism to capitalism was a long, drawn-out, conflictual process, as the transition from capitalism to whatever comes next is likely to be. Before the revolution, a few commoners in the cities had started to become wealthy merchants or increasingly affluent workers, artisans, professionals, the bourgeoisie. But most of the Third Estate consisted of impoverished peasants compelled to rent from nobles the land on which they subsisted and obligated to turn over to those nobles and to the church much of what they produced. Meanwhile, the king and the court lived lavishly, and to the expenses of running the opulent court at Versailles, Louis XVI added the cost of expanding the military. The French government built up a powerful navy to support the war waged by the American colonies for independence from France's longtime rival, Great Britain. In addition to these stark inequalities and military expenses, the country faced a crisis in resources and economy. There was some climate trouble. According to Ernest Belford Bax in his Short History of the French Revolution for Socialists, quote, 10 years of bad harvests culminated with the summer of 1788. All kinds of agricultural crops failed miserably all over France. Not alone wheat and grain generally, but vines, chestnuts, olives, in short, all the natural products of consumption and exportation. Even what was gathered in was so spoiled as to be almost unfit for use. From every province of France came the monotonous tale of ruin, famine, starvation. An English visitor to France at the time commented that such bread as is to be obtained tastes of mold and often produces dysentery and other diseases. The larger towns present the same condition, as though they had undergone the extremities of a long siege. In some places, the whole store of corn and barley has the stench of putrefaction and is full of maggots. To add to the horrors of the situation, upon the hot and dry summer follows a winter of unparalleled severity. The new year of 1789 opens with the Seine frozen over from Paris to Havre. As the spring advances, the misery increases. The industrial crisis becomes acute in the towns. Thousands of workmen are thrown out of employment. The riots and local disturbances, which had for many years past been taking place sporadically in various districts, now became daily more frequent, so much so that from March onwards the whole peasantry of France may be said to have been in a state of open insurrection, 300 separate risings in the provinces being counted for the 4 months preceding the taking of the Bastille. Historian Peter Linebaugh notes, the Bastille towered over its neighborhood in Paris, which was home to artisans and laborers. Its walls were 100 feet high, 10 feet thick at the top, and 30 to 40 feet thick at the base. The monstrous building functioned as an arsenal, a prison, and a fortress guarding the east of Paris from invasion from without and rebellion from within. The symbolism of the Bastille derived from its long use as a prison where, with a secret letter, the monarch could have anyone imprisoned without evidence, trial, or appeal. Kind of like the power of the U.S. president under the National Defense Authorization Act to detain anyone anywhere. Voltaire was imprisoned there in the Bastille, and the Marquis de Sade, and many who escaped or were released described the horrors of its dungeons. When protesters in the neighborhood demanded access to the weapons kept inside, the soldiers stationed there took only a few hours to surrender. Just as, elsewhere in Paris, royal troops were colluding with other crowds protesting their need for bread. While workers, artisans, and peasants were crowding into the streets and plazas, as people have often done in recent years protesting austerity measures and oppressive or unresponsive governments, more privileged revolutionaries in the spring of 1789 were busy drafting a constitution for France. The Estates General began meeting in Versailles after Louis XVI called a meeting of representatives of the first, second, and third estates, that is, the clergy, nobility, and everyone else, to try to resolve some of the country's problems. but they couldn't even resolve a fair structure for the meeting. The Third Estate balked at the idea that their group would have only one of three votes when they represented 97% of the population. So they took the direct action of meeting separately, inviting members of the other estates to join them on an equitable basis. This group, the National Assembly, passed the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, affirming the principles of popular sovereignty and human equality, though unfortunately they failed to pass proposed resolutions ending colonial slavery and including women in the category of citizen. Still, to the extent that despotism was overthrown and replaced by an aspiration toward human equality and the common good, it was accomplished not simply by a polite meeting of the Estates General, but by the combined action of popular uprising and autonomous action of representatives of the Third Estate determined to write popular sovereignty into law. Neither the laborers with their pikes nor the lawyers with their pens could have accomplished alone what they did by their collective actions. The next year, in 1790, after the Bastille had been dismantled stone by stone, the Marquis de Lafayette gave the key to the prison to his friend Tom Paine to pass along to George Washington. The key is now on display at the first president's slave plantation, Mount Vernon. Let's remember that we have that key that opened the door of the despot's prison, and we can, by our collective actions, finish the promised work of human equality and the common good, the abolition of slavery, health care for all, open borders, the abolition of prisons. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle.
It is nice to block the doorway. It is nice to go to jail. There are nicer ways to do it.
This is KBOO Portland, and that was Barbara Dane singing It Isn't Nice. That's one of the songs on Bitch Magazine's mixtape of American protest music. You can find a link to that mixtape list on the audio page for this show in a couple of days on our KBOO webpage at kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll also post links to my comments and sources on Bastille Day and information about Power in Our Hands, the book on labor history from Norm Diamond, whom we heard from at the beginning of today's show. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Fran Michelle. Later this hour, we'll hear from Jan Hocken and Kate Raphael on the Supreme Court's ruling against no-protest buffer zones around abortion clinics. But first, we'll hear from Tom Becker on whether capitalism inevitably produces inequalities.
Good morning. Under capitalism, in Marxist theory, labor becomes just another commodity in the production process. And like any commodity that is in overabundance, its price inevitably falls to the lowest possible minimum. In the case of labor, that price, meaning wages, was that which could keep the workers themselves alive and to raise children destined to toil for the capitalist's own descendants. The absolute immiseration of the working class and the resulting inequality were, for Marx, inherent in the system and must lead to its doom. Through much of the mid-20th century, it appeared to many that this was not the case. Marx and Marxism appeared moribund. Today it appears that such an epitaph may have been premature. I'm now going to share with you an article on Counterpunch entitled "Does Capitalism Inevitably Produce Inequalities?" by Ann Robertson and Bill Lemur. In a recent New York Times op-ed article, the authors begin, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz theorized that capitalism does not inevitably produce inequalities in wealth. Instead, he argues, today's inequalities result from policy decisions made by politicians on all sorts of matter that affect people's income, such as a tax structure that favors the rich. In fact, he concluded, today there are no truly fundamental laws of capitalism. Thanks to democracy, people can steer the economy in a variety of directions, and no single outcome is inevitable. In their 2010 book, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, Yale professor Jacob Hacker and UC Berkeley professor Paul Pearson would seem to add additional support to Stiglitz's conclusion. They argued that economic struggles of the middle and working classes in the U.S. since the late 1970s were not primarily a result of globalization and technological changes, but rather a long series of policy changes in government that overwhelmingly favored the rich. Although there's certainly significant substance to Stiglitz's argument, nevertheless, capitalism is far more responsible for economic inequality because of its inherent nature and its extended reach in the area of policy decisions than Stiglitz is willing to concede. At the very heart of capitalism lies an incentive that leads to the increase of inequalities. Capitalism is based on the principle of competition, and businesses must compete with one another in order to survive. Each company, therefore, strives to maximize its profits in order to achieve a competitive advantage. But in order to maximize profits, business must keep productive costs to a minimum, and a major portion of production costs includes labor. Consequently, as a general rule, in order for a business to survive, it must push labor costs to a minimum. And that is why, of course, so many businesses migrate from the U.S. and relocate in countries like China, Vietnam, Mexico, and Bangladesh, where wages are a mere pittance. This inherent tendency to maximize profits while minimizing the cost of labor directly results in growing inequalities. While Stiglitz is correct in arguing that politicians can influence economic outcomes by policy decisions, what he fails to acknowledge is that these policy decisions themselves are heavily influenced by the economic relations established by capitalism. There is no firewall between the economy and politics. Those who have acquired money from the economic sector can put this money to work in the political sector by lobbying and showering politicians with campaign contributions. The culture of capitalism, because of its hyper-individualism, also produces an extraordinary narrow vision of the world. Viewing the world from an isolated standpoint, individuals tend to assume that they are self-made persons, not the products of their surrounding culture and social relations. So the rich assume that their wealth has been acquired through their personal talents alone, while the seed of those mired in poverty is lacking the ambition and willingness to work hard. People are unable to see the complexities underlying human behavior because of the atomization of social life. But the disciplines of psychology, sociology, and anthropology all concur that individuals are overwhelmingly a product of their social environment to their very core. In 1947, for example, the American Anthropological Association argued in a statement on human rights, quote, "If we begin as we must with the individual, we find that from the moment of his birth, not only his behavior, but his very thought, his hopes, aspirations, the moral values which direct his action and justify and give meaning to his life in his own eyes and those of his fellows are shaped by the body of custom of the group of which he becomes a member," end quote, and end of the sexist language. It is in this more subtle way that capitalism induces growing income inequalities. Capitalist culture engenders a mindset among politicians that leads them to craft public policies in favor of the good people, the rich and powerful, and turn their backs on the poor or punish them with mass incarceration. They think it is entirely natural to accept money from the wealthy in order to fund their reelection campaigns. And the more the inequalities in wealth grow, the more the mindset blinds politicians to destructive implications of these so-called natural decisions. In 2011, Stiglitz wrote a compelling article, Of the 1%, By the 1%, For the 1%, in which he argued forcefully that large inequalities in wealth are in no one's interest. But he went on to say that capitalism has an iron grip on the political process. Stiglitz concluded his article with this prophetic statement. The top 1% have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, and the best lifestyles. But there is one thing that money doesn't seem to have bought: an understanding that their fate is bound up with how the other 99% live. Throughout history, this is something that the top 1% eventually do learn, too late. While Stiglitz's arguments have had no impact on growing inequalities, thanks to the power of capitalism, nevertheless, capitalism gets credit for producing the one force that can put a stop to these destructive trends, the working class. As Karl Marx argued, capitalism produces its own gravediggers. In the 1930s, workers massively organized unions and fought militant battles to defend their right to unionize and the right to fair competition. These unions, which Stiglitz fails to mention, played a decisive role in reining in inequalities and unleashing a period in which the ranks of the middle class grew. As Marx noted in his contribution to a critique of Hegel's philosophy of right, quote, "The weapon of criticism cannot, of course, replace the criticism of the weapon. Material force must be overthrown by material force. But theory also becomes a material force as soon as it has gripped the masses," end quote. Stiglitz's criticisms of growing inequality will have little impact on policy decisions until they are embraced by the masses. The working class, those that capitalism cruelly exploits and are so easily dismissed by politicians and academics. At that point, the working class will finally stand up and collectively declare, enough is enough. That was an article from Counterpunch entitled, "Does Capitalism Inevitably Produce Inequalities?" by Ann Robertson and Bill Loomer. Ann Robertson is a lecturer at San Francisco State University and a member of the California Faculty Association. Bill Loomer is a member of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, retired. Both are writers for Workers' Action.
You who covet power, fame, your wealth, gain, you blinder eyes cannot criticize. Our values twisted from above, but we're taught in school to abandon love. Embrace the dollar, growth, great cancer of expanding markets is all man's aim. Selfish gain, harder laws for harder brains, as if violence teaches peace and calms some beast within, within, within. And a plastic buck for a plastic heart, well, the modern bondage of the credit.
That was Indentured Servant by Greg Kelly, and before that we heard from Tom Becker on the ways that capitalism produces inequalities. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. And next, we're going to hear from Jan Hocken talking with Kate Raphael. Raphael is a longtime feminist and queer activist in the California Bay Area and a host of the Women's Magazine on KPFA Community Radio in Berkeley. And she recently did a piece for that show on the Supreme Court decision on clinic buffer zones.
Welcome to KBOO, Kate Raphael.
Great to be with you.
Well, feminist commentators throughout the country have expressed outrage over two recent Supreme Court rulings, the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby and the McCullen versus Coakley decisions. In the McCullen versus Coakley case, the Supreme Court struck down a Massachusetts law that restricted speech outside abortion facilities, arguing that the law violated the First Amendment because its buffer zone limited speech too broadly. In Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, the court ruled that corporations controlled by religious families cannot be required to pay for contraception coverage for their female workers. Kate, in your KPFA editorials, you spoke in support of the court's ruling around the buffer zone law and against the ruling around corporations' right to deny contraceptive coverage. Let's start by talking about the buffer zone ruling, where there's been more controversy over what's at stake politically. And then perhaps we can turn to the larger struggle for reproductive justice. First, why did you agree with this Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think it's important to separate the two decisions, although, you know, I think there's absolutely no question that the Supreme Court majority is anti-woman and is opposed to our controlling our bodies. So that's not a misinterpretation. But the buffer zone concept, I think, is deeply flawed. And I think that, although I haven't read the decision, I would guess that there are reasons that I would agree with why the three women justices joined the majority in striking down that law. And, I mean, basically, I think it's important to understand where these buffer zones came from. In 1993, Dr. David Gunn was murdered during an anti-abortion protest at a clinic in Florida. And in response to that, the FACE ordinance, Free Access to Clinic Entrances, was passed by the U.S. Congress. So that's a federal law that essentially did nothing that existing laws didn't already do. This was something that was very popular in the Clinton administration, criminalizing things that are already crimes based on a political intent. So the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 did that. Hate crimes legislation, which, you know, basically added enhancements for committing a crime with certain ideology behind it. This was something that the Clinton administration loved and the Bush administration perpetuated and intensified, and it's just gone forward. Unfortunately, now, the law that was struck down in McCullen was not FACE and didn't have anything to do with FACE, but it was one of the many ordinances, one of the many local and state iterations that were inspired by FACE. So I do want to be clear on that, that we're not talking about FACE, but these buffer zone and bubble ordinances that have been passed, you know, the presumption behind them, first of all, is that clinic violence only takes place during protests, and if you prevent protest from occurring in a certain place, then you will prevent clinic violence. So first of all, just practically, that's not the case. They don't actually work. And I don't think, I mean, I've been trying to find statistics and I haven't really found them to say, has clinic violence lessened since the imposition of these buffer zones or not? And I don't think
because they also vary in terms of state. For example, in Oregon, we don't have a buffer zone ordinance, and other injunctions and anti-harassment laws are used to control anti-abortion forces. And these apparently in Massachusetts, the buffer zone was the widest, right?
Well, no, actually. Part of why they struck down this particular law and why it may not mean the death of all of these ordinances all over the country, even though I personally think it would be great if it did, is that this was actually one of the most restrictive, one of the most narrow, in the sense that it only applied to reproductive health clinics. So, for instance, the bubble ordinance that we have here in Oakland, where I live, applies to all medical facilities. So I opposed that on the basis that as a member of ACT UP in the 80s and 90s, I was part of protests outside of hospitals and, you know, clinics. We were protesting the treatment of people with AIDS. We were protesting discrimination. We were protesting the fact that they wouldn't make certain treatments accessible to certain people. You know, I have participated in protests outside of hospitals that don't offer abortion care. And so to me, that's what we should be doing rather than trying to limit protest at medical facilities. I think maybe we should be protesting at medical facilities. But I also think it's important to look at the violence that actually happens. That's the stated reason for these ordinances. And, you know, so 8 providers have been murdered. 7 other abortion providers have been murdered since the tragic death of Dr. Gunn. Some of those were
in Boston that led to this particular law.
Right. And those occurred in the clinic. So a buffer zone, they did not occur during a protest. And a buffer zone would not have prevented that, because obviously everybody who goes to the clinic has to get in somehow. So, you know, access to the clinic, restricting protests outside the clinic or people loitering outside the clinic would not actually have prevented those deaths.
But aren't you...
Dr. Tiller was killed at church, as most people know. Dr. Slepian was killed at home. You know, I became involved in clinic defense in the 1980s, and that was in response to a firebombing of a clinic here in Oakland. And every firebombing that I know about, that one took place at night. Every firebombing I know of has taken place at night when the clinics are closed.
But it seems to me that the social movements often draw on the most vividly, morally horrifying images to advance kind of more everyday kind of chronic oppression. So many clinic staffers throughout the country, including in Massachusetts, say that there is a problem of everyday intimidation and harassment of women who come into the clinics. And in fact, there is a kind of celebratory atmosphere in Boston that where the anti-abortion forces have been kind of revived, apparently, by this ruling. And it may be that movements, in this case, the murder of doctors and other clinic staffers, it was used to mobilize around a more everyday form of harassment. So I think it's not unusual in that sense.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And, I mean, it is absolutely true that the harassment and the haranguing and the attempt to, you know, preach to and convert and accuse women who are going to get services, not all of them getting abortion services either, at these clinics is horrific, and it shouldn't happen. You know, but a lot of things shouldn't happen. It also happens to be a civil right to yell things and be mean to people. Unfortunately, that just is a fact. You know, so for instance, I mean, I know it to be a fact that fat shaming in the form of diet commercials, in the form of you know, fat-shaming motifs on television and in movies account for much more trauma and many more deaths of women every year than anti-abortion protests. You know, anorexia is the leading, the mental illness that has the highest death rate in the country. So we know that to be a fact, but I haven't heard anyone suggesting, I haven't seen feminists working to outlaw diet commercials. You know, the reality is we do not have control over our own bodies. You know, everybody, every fat woman, and I am one, you know, who walks down the street in this country understands very well that people, and especially men, do not believe that we should have the right to control our own bodies and to do what we want with our bodies. So this is a larger social problem, and we need to be working on it as a social problem.
So you're also saying that the abortion rights struggle, pro-choice movement, needs to reframe this from a single issue to think about it more broadly around women's control over their bodies and the terms under which women exercise reproductive choice and other aspects of control over their bodies as a broader, as part of a broader women's movement.
Exactly, and I think that we were doing that, that in the 70s and the early 80s, we were doing that. You know, we had a grassroots movement. We were a very broad, you know, it was a movement that constructed the issues very broadly. So universal health care, for instance, I think a lot of people don't know this, that the feminist movement had universal health care and universal child care as two of its core demands in the early and mid-70s. You know, when there was the first large march on Washington, those were of women by Gloria Steinem and, you know, other what we think of as mainstream feminists now. Those were among the demands. So those were mainstream feminist demands early on that we understood, you know, and I really think this is where the two decisions, McCollum and Hobby Lobby, become acquainted or come together, is that what is really true is that if we had fought, instead of the Affordable Care Act, if we had fought for something more like universal national health care, then we would be taking health care out of the hands of employers, out of the hands of insurers, out of the hands of profit-making hospitals and corporations and even abortion clinics. And you would be, you know, every health center would be required to offer the full range of services, whether you're talking about contraception or asthma medication or mental health or abortion or fertility treatment or prenatal care or postnatal care, right? So, you know, that's what a grassroots feminist movement, I think, would move towards. So, you know, right now there's a reproductive justice movement, which I think has done a very, you know, good and important job of saying, you know, reproductive health is not just about abortion. Choice is not just about abortion, that we need to be looking at it in a broader context. But I would say, you know, we need not just a reproductive justice framework, but we really need a grassroots feminist framework that looks at everything about women's lives.
That's a wonderful concluding statement, and we'll have to continue with that dialogue over what that means and the scope of reviving a broader reproductive justice movement, which is, I think, has been to some extent revived and kind of promising reinvigoration of a broad feminist agenda throughout the country and throughout the world. Thanks, Kate Raphael, so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken and Kate Raphael with Women's Magazine at KPFA San Francisco talking about recent Supreme Court decisions on reproductive rights. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That come together to stand united. The voices of toiling masses gather, our voices heighten. We want our lows lightened, we want our wrongs righted. Any attempt to control our bodies, we poised to fight it. Gon' blame the system, that's accurate.
That's My Body Politic by NC Music Love Army. And before that, Jan Hocken talking with activist Kate Raphael about feminism and who controls women's bodies. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. Our engineer today has been Joe Clement. Thanks to Joe and Jan and Kate and to Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond and Tom Becker for their contributions to today's show. You can find the audio of this show and helpful links on our webpage at KBOO in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be back next week with more from the Mole.